John, it is so good to see you again, my friend. How are you?
Oh, we're doing great, and great to see you too, John.
HeggyLaw.com. And John, you and I have had many conversations on this program over the years. You are one of our very first guests. You and your wife, Corinne, who, by the way, we should mention, is Judge Corinne now, huh?
She certainly is. And she's down at the Daly Center representing the folks at Cook County and doing an excellent job, of course.
She was appointed by the Supreme Court, right?
She was appointed by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who put her into the Chief Justice's committee for a thorough investigation. And Corinne, of course, came out passed with flying colors, and she was nominated. So I couldn't be more excited for her and proud of her at the same time.
Yeah, you guys used to work on the firm together. We talk about how much fun that was for you guys and a challenge, you know, just to do it as a family. And now she's got this whole other new challenge.
Right. So her appointment to her role was, of course, a great thing for every single person in Cook County, except for me.
Yeah, you probably miss her at the firm, don't you?
I sure do.
But it's in trusted hands with John. And what does an estate planning lawyer do? What are you all about?
So, you know, so much of our system is set up when someone passes away and their property has to be given to someone else. We help with that process by doing it ahead of time. So, you know, you mentioned powers of attorney. That's something that we kind of do to help everyone throughout their day-to-day life, to have someone who can act for you when you can't act. But the rest is set up to how are we going to transfer your things to the people that you want them to go to. You know, and if you do that ahead of time, then you can save a lot of time, a lot of money, and a lot of heartache and headache.
It seems simple when you put it like that, but there's a lot of variables. There's a lot of different options for you. I know that they are all very complicated in their own ways, but is there simple ways to kind of describe maybe the two main things that people can do?
Well, you know, we always have the concept of wills and the concept of trust, but there's, you know, a few other things in there too. Basically, you just need to designate where you want your things to go ahead of time. If you do that in the process of a will, that's great. So when a person has more than $100,000 worth of things, like in particular real estate, they have to go through the probate process in the state of Illinois. And there's two versions of probate. There's the kind where you have a will and the kind where you don't. And if you don't have a will, your things may not go where you want them to go. The court decides. Now, it's not on a whim that they decide where it goes.
Right.
They follow a system. But it can lead to some bizarre results. You know, when you have two spouses and they have children, when one spouse passes away, if they don't have a will, their things don't all go to the surviving spouse. Half goes to the surviving spouse and half go to the children. Now, that's not a result most people want. They'd rather leave everything to the surviving spouse to take care of the children with. And then when that spouse passes, things can pass to the children.
And that's if you don't have a will.
And that's if you don't have a will. Bad things can happen. So having a will is a worthwhile thing. It prevents those bizarre results. But, you know, you still have to go through the probate process.
Right.
And that's why a trust is even better. Because if you give up ownership of your things while you're alive and put them into the trust, then when you pass away, you didn't own $100,000 worth of things. Your trust owned them. And then the trust would just execute and pass that property to where it is you had designated it to go.
And with the trust and that passing comes like rules. Corinne used to always say the lineup of who does what, like the batting order. It comes with a standard of set rules and regulations that then the people that execute the trust follow.
Right. And that's the beauty of it. You set up the rules and the regulations and where they go. Well, now, obviously, we guide our clients to do that. We don't make them set up the rules themselves. But, you know, we can point out the options on how to do that. And you know, what happens if this person predeceases you? What happens if this person is 25 or 45 or whatever it is you want to put in there? You can put in. And if you do that ahead of time, you can set the rules.
Can you explain a little bit what probate is?
So probate's the legal process where a property of a deceased person is passed to someone else. So that's I guess a definition from a encyclopedia. Well, not an encyclopedia.
Wikipedia, sure.
Yeah, sure, Wikipedia. So the practical aspect of it is you have to hire a lawyer because you cannot go to probate pro se. Meaning you can't represent yourself. You have to have an attorney. And we submit the paperwork to open a probate, which is to give someone legal authority to make that transfer of the property. you know, we wait a couple months generally before we can get a court date. We go in front of the judge, and they usually say, okay, well, this is this person's child, or this was this person's spouse, so they seem like a good fit to be the representative. And then the court issues that authority to that person to act. And then they can take that letter and go back to the bank account and say, well, I'm now in charge of the deceased person's things, so I'm going to make the distributions per the will or per what the court said.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you go out, you do all that, and it's a, you know, it's a lot of work.
It is.
It's a hassle. And the bank is surprisingly not super cooperative the first time around. And it's hard to sell real estate when the person is deceased and it's not clear, you know, who the exact owner is. And you've got the letter to prove it, but some people don't like that proof. So, you know, it just creates a lot of hassle for the people that you leave behind.
And if the estate owes anything to anybody, the creditors are going to come and get it first.
So the first day the judge signs that order, that opens up a period where anyone who's owed money can come forward. And they do. You know, old credit card debt, a parking ticket you got in Denver in 1976, it's going to show up. I mean, it'll be there. And then that erodes into your estate. So, you know, it's particularly daunting when you have debts that you didn't realize or you didn't remember. It just cuts into the equity of a piece of property, or it cuts into the cash savings. You know, all the types of things that could have been avoided if you stay out of the probate process. And the probate process, you know, I guess I didn't really finish how that ends. You know, after a 6-month period where all the creditors come forward and those claims are satisfied, property is dispersed, it can technically close. And the reality is that's going to be more like a year. And then we will, you know, submit the information to the court, a final accounting, you know, a sworn statement that, you know, everything was done correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and you're looking at probably well over a year in
until
process.
Everything's all settled out. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you've got an open legal matter, and you have to have an attorney, and it takes a year, well, it doesn't take a mathematician to figure out that's going to cost a lot.
Right.
So, you know, the probate process is fine. It works. It's a functioning system. It's just expensive. And if you can stay out of it, all the better.
Okay. So I just want to kind of sum on up here. There's not having a will, and you go to probate, and that's really messy. That's no bueno, because right, you do have an estate plan, but it's the government's plan, and they're going to figure it out for you. There's going to probate with a will, which is better, and there's some clearer things, but it still takes a while. You still need a lawyer,
mm-hmm,
and essentially now your kids are paying for the, not that I want to say the mess, but adjudicating the will that you laid out. Even if it's like perfectly crisp and clear, there's still going to be issues that arise, and creditors get there first.
That's right.
There's a trust, which probably costs a little bit more on the front end, right?
Right.
Because you're using a law service to write up a lot more documents, and there's a lot there, but you avoid probate altogether. Did I get those things right?
That's exactly right.
Boom. It's almost
good
like we've
job
talked about. Thank you, Patrick.
Jeez.
It's almost like we talked about this before. Well, tell you what. Let's take a break. Oh, before I do, in case someone's running out of the car, 847-272-7360. I'm going to say that one more time, John. 847-272-7360. I got that right.
That's right.
HeggieLaw.com. We got a bunch of questions coming on the text and the phone lines. We're going to get to those. And what do you got, Patrick?
No, go
do
ahead.
Do you have a question right now? I was going to go to break.
Yeah, no, go ahead. I'll just ask him when we get back.
That's fine.
Okay.
I'm regretting my decision.
I don't even know if it's a good question, so I'll think about it.
It is going to be a great question.
Okay, thanks, John.
We'll do that after this on WGN. Patrick, did you get your question answered during the break?
I did, yeah. It had to do with whether it's a good idea to put a principal residence in a trust.
And what did John have to say, John?
Well, often it is, but not always.
Okay.
So let us know. You know,
man, two lawyers together, and I'm getting a bottom. Well, it depends. Of course it does. Okay. Well, so it does depend on a few different factors. All right. 773. Is there a time limit on when you can or should open a probate case? My mother passed away 8 years ago. I still have not done anything with her estate. So there's not an automatic trigger that happens, John?
Well, there's quite a few things that you probably should have done now. But there's still a remedy for this.
Okay.
So, I'd love to know about what kind of assets that we have that we're talking about that we need to change ownership on. If there's nothing to probate, like if there was no owned property, or there was the bank account had a beneficiary named, or the house had something called a transfer on death tool attached to it, or an instrument, TODI, then there might not be a need for probate. And we just notify the county that someone is deceased and file their will. I guess it can vary, but I'd be happy to talk to the person about it.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good thing. And that's interesting, because maybe I'm sure it's the exception to the rule that there are some cases that are so simple that they don't need to go through probate, but that is the exception usually, right?
Generally, yes, I'd agree.
Okay. The question is, if you have a trust, 312, does that mean creditors are avoided? That's what they want to know.
Right. So if you don't open probate, there's no time for the there's no time or place for the creditor to submit their claim. So it can avoid that, although, you know, you can't use a trust to commit fraud.
Okay, can you explain that a little bit more? What do you mean?
Well, you can't.
So, like, if you know you owe a bunch of money and you're dodging it, you can't just use the trust to hide that away knowingly and willfully. But let's say you inherit the trust as the executor, you don't know what's going on, no probate is ever opened, that doesn't trigger the creditors to know. You're kind of willfully, you're just blind to that, right?
Right. So I suppose we could look at it. Let's say there's a piece of real estate and it's got 20% equity in it, it's worth whatever the value is. Mm-hmm. But then there's a bunch of credit card debt. Well, credit card debt can't attach to a person if they're deceased. So their only chance to present that would be during the probate process. But if the house had 20% equity in it and it had a way to transfer to the next owner, i.e., it was in a trust or had that transfer on death instrument listed with the county, there would be no opportunity to present those claims.
And that's not fraud?
That's not fraud, no.
Okay. But there would be we're saying you don't stuff away money in places that you're not supposed to.
That's a pretty good rule of thumb.
Okay. Okay, I clearly don't know what I'm talking about. Let's go to Sharon. Sharon's got a question about power. First of all, is it powers of attorney or power of attorneys?
Well, there's
plural.
There's two different ones, right? We like to do the property power, which is really financial power in Illinois, and then the health care power.
Okay.
So it's two powers.
All right. Sharon, ask me your powers question.
Hi, yes. Well, I've finally determined the two different types, but I've heard of a springing power of attorney, which would go into effect when you are unable to conduct your business. But when you have that, I then was told that the only way that somebody could actually help you if you were in a hospital or whatever is if you signed an additional form that would allow them to access your records, which makes sense. However, when I was shown the form, it seemed like it turned into a durable power of attorney where you basically give up your thoughts. If I sign a durable power of attorney, doesn't that mean I'm giving my power to somebody today?
So durable power of attorney is generally a term that's more associated with the property power of attorney or financial power of attorney.
Well, okay.
So if we say a healthcare power of attorney, sort of the standard form that comes from Illinois, and if you're not seeing this sort of standard form, then that's another conversation. But it would generally say, who you name is your healthcare agents, and they take over for you making healthcare decisions only when you can't. Or you could decide to let them take over now. Most people don't. And that generally is incapacitation / consciousness, because you're going to be in a healthcare environment if you're using a healthcare power of attorney. So there's going to be an expert there that can determine this person is not conscious. Therefore, they would then put the agent in charge. And it is durable in the sense that it continues on throughout your lifetime unless you cancel it or make a new one.
So that is always there, but that trigger still needs to take place.
Yes.
The trigger needs to take place, but you're not required to sign an additional form that... The one that I read, it sounded like it was like this is springing until somebody actually needs to access your records, and then you got to sign one that basically becomes permanent.
Hmm. Well, no, it never becomes permanent in healthcare. If you regain consciousness or you're feeling better, you're back in charge of yourself. The agent only acts when you cannot act,
and that's made by a healthcare provisional.
That's the law.
That's why the second one that was shown to me didn't make a whole lot of sense.
Oh, you can always you can always call and follow up, and that's always what we recommend, Sharon. Let me give you the Hegging line is right now, 847-272-7360. John's always welcoming to talk to people about what's going on, 847-272-7360. Let's go to the phone lines. Let's at least get this question on in here. Sharon, thank you for the call. We're going to Brandon. Brandon, what do you got?
Hi. I guess hindsight's 2020.
Always.
Excuse me. Well, grandma and grandpa, they worked all their lives, they save up money, and they put the money into a trust. Grandpa passes away, grandma goes into a nursing home. And you pay your bills, with the money that she saved up and all that. Well, the money's, she outlived her money. She's 98 now. Mm. And I was talking to my dad about it. Mom passed away. I talked to dad about it. And he says, why didn't you tell the nursing home to, I don't know, scratch it or whatever, and then put her on, like, Medicaid or, I mean, I don't want to, or something.
Right. So she's, so she's out of money, you're saying.
Money. And I said, well, I don't know how, you know, that would have worked, where you try to do the right thing or whatever, but it's like, because the money was in a trust, you have to.
I think we have a little connection.
Yeah. Can you? So I know the topic that you're getting to. So there's all kinds of trusts. Like the kind that I'm talking about here are grantor revocables, meaning you make the rules, you can change the trust anytime you want. And then there are irrevocable trusts where you cannot change the rules. You make it once and that's that. And then sort of within the irrevocable trust world, there is something that's commonly referred to as a Medicaid trust, or it's an elderly law. It's the subsection of attorneys at practices. And then what they do is they create a trust that the person who gave up the things cannot access it anymore. And it's a vow of poverty. It is that person cannot benefit from that trust in any sort of way. But if they've set it up far enough in advance, then the person who becomes ill, who set up the trust, can receive government aid for their days left on this earth. But it is a extreme vow of poverty. Like they there's no cake and eat it too. They give up that ownership and it's gone. And it can exist for the benefit of their descendants or someone else later in their, after they pass away. But they cannot enjoy it at all. So,
for themselves,
yeah. So it is There's no getting around it. Which I know it's a popular topic.
That seems
topic.
Scary.
It is. Yeah. You're talking about they might get an extra pair of slippers and an extra blanket.
Well, what's the advantage for doing one of those then?
There's no advantage to the person who made the trust. It just allows some assets could exist for the next generation.
So when you are going to set up a trust, please make sure you're talking with someone you trust, pun intended, to make sure they set up the right one and you understand your rights. Go ahead, Patrick.
I just wondering, there are tax benefits. Like, why is the person even doing that?
Yeah, I don't really know. But tell you what, why don't we pick up this conversation after the news here on WGN. To my left is John Heggie from Heggie Walkner Law Firm. You can go to heggielaw.com. Call him at 847-272-7360 for all wills and trusts. To my right is Patrick Dolan, who I asked to linger around after our employment law conversation. You had a question for John.
I did, yeah. As an attorney, I enjoy talking to other lawyers who do things that I don't do. In other words, not employment law. So, I listen to you. I think it's really interesting. Do you like what you do?
I do like it. For a lot of reasons, it's not all good news. You know, when someone didn't have an estate plan and they come in and you see the real life implications of someone's whatever assets they had left, getting eaten up by the costs of the courts or my own fees or just, whatever creditors they may have had that they could have avoided. That's bad. But most of the time when people come in, it's a real dark subject. You're talking about your demise and what you're going to do with your stuff. But you have that difficult conversation and then you're done. Because when you have an estate plan and it's a thorough, complete estate plan, you don't need to worry about anything. And to see the people's relief when they leave the office is always great. And then when you help someone administer a trust that their parents had set up for them, and they're like, wow, mom and dad really thought about everything here. This is really, they really took care of us. To see those results is always pleasing.
Yeah, it seems like a real helping profession. A lot of the practice of law, frankly, really isn't. But there are certain areas of law that really are. You really help people. And that's, I just enjoy listening to it. Because you obviously have a lot of opportunities to help folks.
You do too, Patrick. You help people.
Yeah, thanks, John.
I was just letting you know.
I try to.
It's another John.
Yeah.
No, all right, 219. We had some great questions on the text line. My husband and I set up a trust about 5 years ago. We moved out of that state 18 months ago to another state. Do we need to revise anything, or is it still valid no matter which state we live in, John?
Yeah, so that's always a funny little topic, right? Because law is generally centered around the states. So as long as you don't need to change anything within that trust, wherever you set it up in, it still works here. But if you need to change any aspect, like if you have another child or you want to change where the beneficiaries go, you have to do that with a local attorney.
Okay, so you got to do a local attorney in the state just to do a once-over, a pass-over, essentially?
Well, you know, if there's a change, like, you know, because okay. you can always change your trust.
I
if
see
you
what
say,
you're saying.
Like, I don't want my kids having access to stuff until they're, say, 35, not 25. Well, that you would have to do with a local attorney.
Okay.
But otherwise.
Generally speaking, you're fine.
Yep.
847, what are your thoughts on a transfer on death instrument for transferring our Illinois home to our children upon our passing? Seems uncomplicated and straightforward. Your thoughts?
It is uncomplicated and straightforward and underutilized across the state. You know, this is a great thing we have in the state of Illinois. It's not everywhere where you can transfer residential your residence. You can't do commercial property upon someone's passing. It's oftentimes it's a one part of a complete estate plan, but it's a great tool. And absolutely, if you have beneficiaries for all of your other assets and things are going to pass, the TODI is just sort of the last piece of that puzzle.
630 says, last parent just passed away. First of all, sorry, 630. The will is in place, they say. The beneficiaries all named. No real estate. Only investments in bank accounts only. No debt. What are my next steps?
So we need to find out if those bank accounts had beneficiaries named. And if they did, then that property will just pass to those beneficiaries named. If they did not, then we need to get someone to be put in charge of the will, whoever was named as the executor, to go to the court to prove that this is in place and then present the order from the judge to those financial institutions.
Okay. 815 wants to know, I have a will. I have one wife, and I've only had one wife. I have one child. Should I create a trust? And I know that's a range of possibilities, so they have a couple follow-ups. Is there a cost range for doing the trust? And then one of the arguments about why you maybe pay a little bit more now for a trust as opposed to probate, and this is the second question, what is the general range for probate proceedings, assuming if you didn't have a trust and you had to go to probate? So
right.
Tackle those one at a time. Should I create a trust?
Almost always. You know, the way our system works, a trust offers so many benefits. But, you know, the downside is you have to pay for it up front, you know, versus when you go through probate, well, one, you're deceased.
You're not paying
for anything. But it comes out of your estate, and it does cost more. You know, a probate, you know, any kind of probate that's less than $5,000 would be shocking.
Really?
And, you know, the sky's the limit on a complicated case, but, you know, even for a pretty standard one. I mean, there's just so many things you have to do, like, you know, putting a notice in a paper. You know, I think that's what's keeping half the papers floating, you know, are these notices we're putting in there. They're not cheap. You know, you got to have an attorney time. You can't be pro se when you deal with the court. So the cost goes up quite a bit. Most estate planning, you know, you can find out from Dr. Google, generally run in that $3,000 to $5,000 range. You know, for a basic kind of program. Sometimes you can come in less than that. It sort of depends on if you need a trust that contemplates tax benefits, if you need that tax planning aspect, or if it's just just to avoid probate into a joint type trust.
Would it be fair to say that generally speaking, a trust will most likely, there's obviously extenuating circumstances, be under $5,000, and most probate situations, extenuating circumstances aside, will be over $5,000.
As a general rule, I wouldn't disagree.
Okay.
Good, John.
I know. Let's see how I did that.
Yeah.
So good there summary. It is. The only difference is you got to pay for the trust and your kids don't have to pay for it. But it's like your final gift to them, I guess. And I say that kind of in jest, but in a nice way too.
Yeah. I mean, in addition to all the headache and heartache and all the, you know, the actual dollar amounts, it is a gift.
Right. 847 says, going back to the point about the conversation about making an estate plan can be sad, I work for a charity, not a cherry, that is a fruit, no one works for that. I work for a charity, and many donors to leave gifts to charities in their estate plans find that part of the conversation uplifting and inspiring. They feel so good knowing that part of their legacy will go to help a cause or those in need. That's an awesome text, John. Is that a good way to look at it?
I think so. I mean, that's the mindset that makes it a little bit easier for you. I find most people work through the process when they walk out the door. If they came in sad, they walk out happy.
But that could be a motivating factor to even get in the door.
Absolutely.
Like if you have things that you care about, charities you care about, and you want money to go there, maybe that's your motivation this year to set up that estate plan. If that's what it takes to get you to have that conversation, whatever it takes, we're taking.
I support that.
All right,
yeah, but
it
seems like the motivation is enough just for your own family, taking care of your own family.
Well, you would think
there's
so, Patrick.
There's so many headaches when you die, you know what I mean, for other people.
Right.
This is a huge one that they don't have to deal with.
But, you know, it's hard to think about that day, and maybe it's a way to avoid it.
Yeah.
You might be cool with it, Patrick, but
other people are cool with it, John.
A lot of people are
weird. Seems like such a stress relief for you and other people. Just do it.
Right. Good point. All right. I think that's a slogan someone else used. Just do it.
Really? I don't know.
I don't think John Heggie can use just do it. I think he did face a trademark violation from a big shoe company out west. Let's go to Natalie. Natalie's got a question. Hey, Natalie.
Hi. Well, I have a few short questions. Okay. Number one, when you have accounts and you set up beneficiaries, why is it necessary now, when they ask you to put the individual you list as a beneficiary, to list their social? How many people know the social security number of, say, a good friend? And with all the fraud today, who would want to give their social security number? It would be different if you were a spouse. Number two,
well, let's answer these one. Let's answer these one at a time. That's going to be way easier because I will not remember your first question in a minute. So, okay. It's social security number. I know people are wary about that, but is that just the way it works and that's how you got to do, John?
You know, the financial institutions themselves make their rules on how on the information they require, but good gosh, I agree with Natalie. That's scary.
Yeah, especially if it's not a spouse, if it's a friend. Okay, Natalie, question two.
Okay, I had a situation where a very close relative had an aneurysm.
Oh.
After 4 days, they wanted to take them off life support. I called the attorney because I knew they had something in place, and I told the attorney what was going on. She told me to call her back, let her know what happened. Anyway, the close family member passed. Mm-hmm. At that time, it was a disagreement about whether they were to be cremated or buried. I specifically remember the family member telling me when they die, they hope they have drive-through cremations. They did not want to go to a cemetery. But the other family member said, I don't remember them saying it. Well, I called the lawyer back. She told me to get the will. I told her I thought she had the will. She said no. She said the person that died had the original. She has a copy stored in a vault. How are families to know all of this in crucial moments if the deceased didn't tell you what they were doing? You just knew about the lawyer. If you've never dealt with a will, how do you know they need the original? And my third point, after 6 years, located the original by storing up everything they had in boxes and only going through those boxes when another family member became ill and had to put in a rail to help them get around, found the original, took it to a lawyer. They did what they had to do. What about any credit card bills? Okay, so I'll leave it at that and listen.
Natalie, you're bringing up, and I, first of all, sorry to the things you've had to deal with, and credit to you for being someone that wants to figure this out for the people that you love. You seem like someone that is trying to help these sort of situations out. But John, she raises a lot of really interesting points about, like, when someone, where is the will? Who is the lawyer? Natalie knew at least who the lawyer was. Mm-hmm. If you don't communicate these things to your family that you've done these plans, how does it work?
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, I want to work backwards, though, in the issue of the credit card bills. You know, one thing everyone needs to remember is don't spend your own money to cover a deceased person's bills. That's never something that's required of you as executor of the will or as agent of or anything else. Just don't spend your own money. So the idea of the cremation, you know, a lot of that time that direction is given in the will. The attorney retaining a copy of the will is very common, and you know there should be some information in there regarding that. Natalie didn't go into what the result of that was, but it is something that when you're making a will, you can contemplate that and put that in if you have specific issues. The state does require an original will be filed. There are exceptions to that where you can get a copy admitted, but in general, they want the original because you can change your will at any point, and they want to see the last version that you had.
The state wants a copy, or they want an original. Excuse me.
Yes, they like the original, and the state of Illinois does vary. But you can, if you need to get a copy admitted, oftentimes you can, but not always. The original is best, and you do need to keep your documents in a place. We use the phrase, you know, where if a person was looking for them, they could find them, with your other important documents. That has come up before. You know, we hear cases all the time. Last summer, there was a case about Aretha Franklin, and there was a will that was found
in the couch
5 years later. And you know, Illinois has a little bit. There were some oddities of that story about one witness and all that kind of stuff. Illinois does it a little differently, but you know, if your attorney retains a copy for you, that should at least give you some direction on what's happening. And when the person's in the healthcare environment and they were going to cease life support or not, the healthcare power of attorney agent is in charge of that. And whoever that person designated to be their agent is the one who can make that decision.
Okay.
Does the attorney typically file the will?
Well, it's not required, but in practice, oftentimes we will. You know, it's not very hard to do.
Right. I don't even know where you would do that.
Well, you just filed at the clerk's office, and you can do that in Cook County and some of the branch offices as well.
Sounds good. We got to take a commercial break. Got a lot of great more texts coming in. If you're just getting out of the car and you're wondering, I got to do this, 847-272-7360 to talk to John Heggie or HeggieLaw.com. Quick break, then we'll wrap things up here on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association on WGN. A few more minutes left with John Heggie and Patrick Dolan from Heggie Wachner Law Firm and Conti and Dolan Law. And we did employment law the first hour, and now we're wrapping up our conversation about estate planning. A couple more questions for you, John. You ready to go?
You bet.
773, if your only asset is a 401k, so I assume no property. I'm assuming they have bank accounts too, but let's just say, okay, 401k in that, and you name a beneficiary, do you need a trust or a will?
Well, you know, if you name a beneficiary for everything you own, you can pretty much get rid of all those big assets. You probably wouldn't have to go to probate. Your personal property, your stuff, you know, your jewelry, your golf clubs, your baseball card collection will probably total less than $100,000. And those can be given away via a will using a small estate affidavit.
So if you like have beneficiaries for your 401k, you have a transfer on death for your mm-hmm. house, and you've named your beneficiaries for your bank accounts, and that's it, you might be okay.
Yeah, and you know, you run a risk though. When you're naming beneficiaries, you run the risk that person is there to receive the property.
Ah, yes.
So we don't really, doesn't cover contingencies. Like a trust would say, I give everything to Bob. If Bob predeceases me, then I give it to Bob's kids. And if Bob's kids predecease me, I give it to my nearest cousin. You know,
whatever it is.
We always leave that to cover every contingency. We never want to have a dead end because, you know, a trust is a big tool to keep you out of probate. But if you designate beneficiaries for everything you own and they're there to receive it, you can avoid probate that way also.
But having like multiple kids complicates things, right?
Generally. In so many ways, John.
Yeah.
Let me just say.
Even while you're alive.
Especially while you're alive. I don't care when I'm dead.
But no, I mean, that makes things can be a little squirrely, right, John? I mean, that's what having a trust and laying out the game plan makes it a lot better.
For sure. Absolutely.
708, I have a will and a trust. Is it recommended to title all checking and savings accounts in the name of the trust?
So savings accounts, yes, always. Your checking account, probably not. You're going to deal with the Social Security on that. There's some banking rules around auto debits and you know, ACHing things out of a trust account that you probably would drive yourself crazy trying to keep up with. So just keep that checking account out and keep the balance low so it doesn't trigger that $100,000 limit.
Why would someone have a will and a trust?
Well, again, it's the contingency thing. So like it takes your personal property, it puts it in the trust, or maybe you bought a piece of property that you forgot to put in the trust or whatever it happened. Your will in that case just says one thing. It just says, I give everything to my trust. It's called a pour over will, meaning up, scoop up all my remaining assets and pour them over into the trust. Now, it still has to run through probate if you do that, but it is your kind of last, your backstop that prevents something from messy happening.
Okay. Someone texted in 773. I don't know if we'll know the answer to this. Can a person on Social Security Insurance, SSI, that's what that is, right?
Yes.
Inherit a house? I don't see why not, right? Or is there rules against that?
So, you know, if you're on Social Security, i.e. retirement, sure, you know. But if you're qualifying for that as a government benefit, the government's going to want to look at your assets.
I see what you're saying. Yeah. So this would maybe make their estate bigger than it was before.
Right.
And they might not
qualify. And that's, you know, that happens. And so that's why it's important for whoever's going to give that house to make sure it doesn't go to that person. or if that makes sense economically, whatever it is they want to do. But that's the kind of planning that you got to be careful of.
847 with, I think, my favorite question and a good one to wrap up on. I missed this whole program. Is there a recording? Yes, there is. And that's a great way to always to end things. WGNradio.com. Iridian is nodding across the glass. We're going to separate the hours. And I think the whole thing goes out, too. But we got Patrick Dolan's hour, all things employment law. Some great questions there, right, Patrick?
Yes, it was great.
How can people reach you and Karen? Karen does the family law. You do the business or the employment law. How can people reach you?
312-332-7800.
Say that slower.
Oh, sorry. 312-332-7800. I'll give a shout out for Iridian. She puts the stuff on the WGN site really fast.
Yeah. It's gonna be, your
She's
hour,
phenomenal.
Your hour might already be up. John Heggie, how can people reach you?
Always at 847-272-7360. Our website is heggielaw.com, H-E-G-G-I-E, law. Or, and that's my email, jheggie@heggielaw.com.
jheggie@heggielaw.com. Say hello to Judge Corinne for me. Okay?
I will indeed.
Gentlemen, this was fun. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, I learned a lot.
I did too.
Yeah,
I always do.
It was great.